The last few years have been pretty tough, and I don't know about you guys, but I don't see any particular reason to think that the next few years will be any easier. So I found myself asking a lot in recent years what art can possibly do to speak to us in times like these. And it's not a new question. Writing in 1969, John Berger said, quote, "The validity of art itself is in question. There is not a significant artist in the world who is not asking himself whether his art is justified, not on account of the quality of his talent, but on account of the relevance of art to the time in which he is living." That was 1969, a year after the defeat of the May 68 protests, and it's not at all clear that society has moved into a more positive direction since then. In fact, in many ways, it seems like our problems just keep getting bigger while our leaders keep getting smaller. And I won't recount for you here the list of all the challenges we face or the uncertainties about the future, but I think many of you will know what I mean when I say that sometimes it can feel like we're living through a prelude to civilizational collapse. And I, for one, have been having trouble finding art that speaks to me in times like these. Nevertheless, it did occur to me a few days ago that the question framed in this way, does this art speak, is not a very good question. First of all, the answer almost always seems to be no, and second of all, it doesn't really give you any information. So for the past few days, what I've been doing is I've been trying to flip that question around into something a little bit more constructive. Something like, who does this art speak to? And I've been going around and I've been looking at stuff through that lens in the hopes that even if I don't see any art that particularly moves me or inspires me, nevertheless, I might learn something from the experience of looking at it. So that's what today's episode is going to be about. Today, I want to bring you some of the results of that mental experiment. Now, some of you may know, my partner Georgina and I are going to be splitting our time between New York City and Santiago de Chile for the foreseeable future. And a few days ago, I decided to take a walk from our apartment down to the Museo de Bellas Artes, the Fine Art Museum, and apply this lens to whatever work I came across. Here, for what it's worth, is what I saw. Apologies for the crappy audio. I'm still getting set up in the new space and promise the next recording will be better. This is Capital A, Episode 14, Who Does Art Speak To? Capital A is sponsored by my good friends at Shoestring Press in Brooklyn. Here is a note from my longtime collaborator, Lane Sell. Shoestring Press is celebrating 7 years of doing its thing. And boy, did they do that thing this year. They locked that thing down, moved that thing around, reassembled that thing across the street, and opened that thing back up. So here they are, doing that thing. If you're a printmaker, painter, or draftsman looking for space to do your thing, Shoestring is the thing for that thing. With facilities and flexibility for silkscreen, etching, relief print, lithography, oil painting, book arts, papercraft, whatever your thing may be, especially those things. They've got lessons to learn a thing and a curmudgeonly master printer to help make your thing. Visit Shoestring online at shoestringpressny.com
and schedule a visit to Classen Avenue's oldest print shop for a tour.
Santiago de Chile is a city that wears the scars of the 20th century right on its face. In 1970, Chile democratically elected a socialist president. In 1973, Uncle Sam, acting through the CIA, helped to overthrow that democratically elected president and installed a right-wing dictator who proceeded to arrest, torture, and murder thousands of Chileans for the next two decades. While he was busy murdering his own citizens, our boy in Chile also helped the United States develop the economic doctrine of neoliberalism. A whole bunch of American-trained economists came down from the University of Chicago to make Chile the world's first laboratory for neoliberal economic policy, with the result that today, Chile has the third highest economic inequality in South America. Which is saying quite a friggin' lot, especially considering that we did this to them. This was an American doctrine promulgated by an American puppet dictator. Now, all of this came to a head 2 years ago, when the government tried to raise the subway fare by a measly few cents, and the entire country exploded in a series of protests and street violence that lasted for months. Now, 2 years later, a lot of the destruction and the graffiti from those protests is still visible in many places throughout the city, and while the current center-right president has managed to hold on to his seat, the country has called a special assembly to rewrite the constitution, which is the same constitution that was put in place by our puppet dictator friend. So that process is still ongoing, and its result is going to be anybody's guess. So that's the context in which, on a beautiful spring morning, because remember the seasons are reversed down here, I am walking down the Mapocho River, the central river that winds its way through the city, and asking myself the question, who does art speak to? And the first art that I encountered were the beautiful riverside parks that I was walking through. The south side of the Mapocho River is lined in both directions with these linear parks. They have good bones, lush vegetation, gorgeous views of the mountains and the city skyline. Who did these parks speak to? Well, there were definitely people using them. There were joggers, there were bicyclists, there were couples picnicking, but overall, the most obvious users of the park were homeless people. One park after another was just covered in the tents of the homeless. And so, through no fault of the designers that made the park or the maintenance crews that take care of it, these gorgeous public spaces were unable to speak to the broad public that they were meant to serve. Now, I don't blame the homeless. I think it's a hopeless business keeping homeless people out of parks. As long as people are not given what they need to live a life of basic dignity, there will always be tents pitched in the most beautiful public parks. There will always be begging and urination in the grandest boulevards. And the most well-designed public spaces will serve only those whom society has given no place to call home. The second group of artworks I encountered were the grand public monuments that were littered throughout these riverside public parks. The Parque Forestal, in particular, is lined with monumental bronzes commemorating great leaders and episodes in Chilean history. Many of them are actually quite beautiful. In our cynical age, we tend to sneer at public artwork of this kind, especially if it's patriotic. But there must be some reason that for millennia, all kinds of governments, from monarchies to tribal councils to communists and fascists, have invested such incredible amounts of time and money into public artworks. What are they supposed to be doing? Who are they supposed to speak to? Well, I'm not the first person to say this, but in their ideal form, public monuments are supposed to construct a national subject. What does this mean? It means that in the moment when these public monuments speak to you, you are supposed to become an idealized citizen, someone with no class, no gender, no race, someone whose only characteristic is their belonging to the nation, their pride in belonging to that nation. Alternatively, if you come from somewhere else, These public monuments are supposed to construct you as an idealized extra-national subject, which is to say a visitor with no particular background of their own, who is impressed or seduced by the country's power, its history, its glory. Leaving aside whether all of this is a good idea or not, do they work? Do public monuments speak to us as national or extra-national subjects? I would argue that in Chile, they do not have the chance to do this, because in Chile, they are absolutely covered in graffiti. They didn't always used to be covered in graffiti. All of this is left over from the Estallido, the nationwide protest that broke out 2 years ago over the hike in the subway fare. And whether because the government hasn't bothered to remove it, or whether because every time it gets removed, it gets put back up, the graffiti is still there as a visible reminder of that time for everybody to see. Now, in some ways, the graffiti itself is a kind of public artwork. Many of it is quite beautiful, and from a certain postmodern point of view, the multiple colors and the clashing contrasts covering these monumental bronzes actually becomes a sort of beautiful tapestry, something very unusual and striking for the eye to encounter. So let's for a moment take the graffiti itself as an artwork. Who does it speak to? Well, the graffiti wasn't univocal. A lot of it expressed solidarity for the protesters, and so had a sort of left-wing lean to it. But there was also a lot of right-wing stuff. I saw more than one hammer and sickle crossed out, for example. And some of it, quite a bit of it, was actually just nonsensical or had no particular political message at all. One of the messages that I read said, "Muy gris," very gray, on top of a gray building. Another message was the mysterious "No comas cadáveres," don't eat cadavers. Now, graffiti and street art can be extremely sophisticated, but the sense that I got from this rather random assortment of protest graffiti was that it was the sort of voice of the crowd, and it addressed a general subject, what Lacan called the big other. The big other is a kind of difficult idea to get your head around, but basically, it's a kind of stand-in for society itself that's implicitly present whenever people exchange words, the implied point of view of a dispassionate observer. It's the same subject you address when you kind of throw your hands up in the air looking for someone to sympathize with your plight. It's a sort of invisible god or an invisible audience that is capable of validating your experience, validating and sympathizing with what you're going through. As an example, when characters in TV and film look at the camera and break the fourth wall, the subject they are addressing is the big other. It's not any one person present, but a stand-in for a general, dispassionate observer. But the big other need not be so innocuous either. Here's a good example from Milan Kundera's The Unbearable Lightness of Being, a short passage about the editor of a resistance newspaper. Quote, "He was accustomed to his readers, and when one day the Russians banned his newspaper, he had the feeling that the atmosphere was suddenly 100 times thinner. Nothing could replace the look of unknown eyes. He thought he would suffocate. Then one day he realized that he was constantly being followed, bugged, and surreptitiously photographed in the street. Suddenly he had anonymous eyes on him, and he could breathe again. He began making theatrical speeches to the microphones in his walls. In the police, he had found his lost public." So in my reading, protest tags like this stand for the voice of the crowd, society's unconscious itself, and the art of the crowd addresses a general subject. But this art of the crowd is really only capable of saying one thing, not this, anything but this. Because of the multifarious nature of these protest tags, they are never capable of articulating a particular vision. They have no political allegiance or program. They cannot tell you what they want. They can only ever tell you what they don't want. The voice of the crowd is only capable of saying no. Hence also the political ambiguity of the crowd as a concept. One minute, the crowd is revolutionary. The next, it is reactionary. First, it stands with the Jacobins. Then it is cutting off their heads. There is no party of the crowd. The only thing it stands for is a blank refusal of the way things are. That said, however, there is one other interesting thing that protest tags like this can do when they are applied on top of public monuments, and that's change the addressee of those monuments. I mentioned before that the ideal addressee of a national monument is a national subject. What tags do when they are applied on top of one of these public monuments is they show that the national subject is a fiction. But more than this, what happens is those tags make clear for us who the true addressee of those public monuments really is. Not the citizens as a whole, not the spirit of the nation, but only the most powerful citizens of a nation state. Those are the people that get up in arms about the disfiguration, defacement of public work. Not exclusively, of course. There are people who care for history, there are people that feel a particular connection to the place that they were born, and there are xenophobes and racists for whom public monuments give a particular jolt of patriotic fervor. But on the whole, the poor and downtrodden don't give a shit about public monuments. So what protest tags like this do is they show us that there can be no national subject as long as the people of that nation remain uncared for. As long as people suffer, the oligarchs and racists will be the only ones that even the most grandiose monuments will speak to. Eventually, I got to the museum itself. The museum staff here, as museum staff are almost everywhere, were extremely helpful and excited to see you. Excepting a few blockbuster museums like the MoMA and the Brooklyn Museum, museum staff everywhere are deeply concerned with this question, who does art speak to? Because for decades now, it has been unclear whom museums are supposed to serve. 100 years ago, it was clear. Museums were for the elite. But today, who do they serve? Are museums for tourists? Are museums for oligarchs? Most museum staff will tell you, and they will believe it earnestly, that museums are for the people. The trouble is, the people do not go there. The art and the institution do not speak to them. I know there's a raging debate about this, and it's a debate that I'm only marginally aware of, but from my outsider's perspective, it seems to me that this problem is not for lack of trying on the part of museum staff, who, on the whole, and this is just my impression, are very eager to get the people, whoever the people might be, into the museum. My impression is that most museum staff really believe in this mission, and they would only be too happy if working class people, people of color, disadvantaged groups of all kinds started showing up in droves to their museum. But of course, on the whole, the audience for museums is generally composed of middle class tourists, well-educated professionals, and moneyed donors. Disadvantaged groups simply do not feel welcome there, because they know that culture is one of the things that elites use to justify their power. And as much as they might be suspicious of that fact, the magic spell is enough to keep them out of the palaces of culture. Until all members of society can be made to feel welcome and desired, museums and the art inside them will only ever speak to tourists and a thin slice of the well-educated or well-moneyed elite. The first thing you see when you get into this museum is a central hall covered in plaster, marble, and terracotta copies of classical sculptures. Now, I really hate to speak ill of this museum because I think, again, the staff are really courteous and earnest. They're really trying, and actually a lot of the curation is very, very good. But this central hall of copies was one of the saddest things I have ever seen. All of these fumbled copies, many of them with proper proportions but poor detailing or terrible texture, seemed hardly able to speak to anyone at all. Perhaps the best copy in this central hall was a large terracotta copy of the head of Michelangelo's David. It was pretty good, but seeing it like this really kind of shook me. I stood in front of it for long moments wondering if everything that I had known and loved from classical art had always already been dead. And it's not just me. For decades and decades now, contemporary culture, both high and low, has been renegotiating its relationship with all this dead white guy art stuff. Could it be, I wondered in that moment, that all these naysayers were right? That the cannon never spoke to most people, that it was always an elitist exercise, and that it's finally time to relegate it to the scrap heap of history? Well, this little moment of doubt notwithstanding, ultimately, I think it's pretty difficult to deny that the art of the past must have spoken at some point in the past, and that therefore it can probably speak again. But it does raise an interesting intellectual problem. Up until this point on my walk, I had been positing that one of the reasons the art around me was failing to speak was because of this historical moment of massive inequality and despair about the future that we are all living through. But the thing is, as unequal and unjust as things are now in 2021, they were massively more unequal in the 16th century, when the David, for example, had been made. Renaissance Florence was literally a feudal society. Venice, the next republic over, traded slaves. Clearly, it's a lot easier to be alive in 2021 than it was in 1520. If the works of the past spoke then, and if they are failing to speak now, obviously inequality is only part of the story. I think the answer to this riddle is once again the question, not does art speak, but who does art speak to? For most of its history, high art spoke to the high-born. This makes sense, because the vast majority of the population were illiterate peasants and had neither the time nor the invitation to enjoy art. Then, in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries, something changed. For a brief moment, barely two centuries long, there was this short-lived idea that humanity was not condemned to repeat the cycles of violence and injustice over and over again for all eternity. That maybe, just maybe, things were progressing. That the future might be better than the past. That the arc of the universe might bend towards justice. This dream went by different names in different places. Some called it the Enlightenment, others the Communist Horizon, still others the American Dream. But its basic features were everywhere the same. That tomorrow would be better than today, and that a better future awaited all of us, not just those lucky enough to be born to the aristocracy. For the scant few decades that we believed in this dream, it also seemed possible that art itself might no longer be just for the high-born, that all of society might be the proper beneficiary of human genius, knowledge, and culture. But then another something happened. The 1980s happened. Thatcher-Reaganism happened. The neoliberal reaction came like a thief in the night and stole the dream of progress. Silly peasants, hope is for the rich. Now, the irony is that while millions and billions around the globe today are better off than they were a century ago, the fact that they are worse off than they were 50 years ago breeds anger and resentment. The genie of the dream of progress can never again be safely put back into the bottle. And this is, I think, both a good thing and a bad thing, for while most of us are far better off than our ancestors in the Middle Ages, we are also probably more restless, more angry, more aggrieved. The difference is that our ancestors in the Middle Ages had never been promised any more than what they had, while we, within living memory, have been the addressees of the dream of progress. And now, we feel betrayed. This brief sketch of human history is crude at best, and it leaves out basically every corner of the globe except for Europe and North America. But I think it does have the advantage of explaining, in overly general terms, this little zigzag formation. First, art spoke to the aristocrats. Then, briefly, it spoke to the people. Now, it all feels dead, and it will continue to feel dead until such a time when we no longer think the dream of progress was a lie. There were other shows in the museum, some of them fairly interesting, though the things that stood out to me the most were the curatorial statements and not so much the art. But I want to finish today's episode with a brief reaction to an article in the New York Times that my partner pointed out to me the same day that I walked down to the museum. It was about the Polish-born artist Agnieszka Kurant, and while I've previously found some of her work fairly interesting, it was really the write-up of the concepts behind her work that struck me this time around. Quote, Courant's driving passion is collective intelligence, phenomena in which vast numbers of independent agents cooperate to produce unpredictable, novel, and complex behaviors. Collective intelligence is present in bacterial colonies, slime molds, human cities, online communities, and artificial intelligence systems. Picture flocks of starlings wheeling through the air, thousands of male fireflies flashing in perfect unison to attract mates, or social movements that coalesce on Twitter and erupt into the streets. But could collective intelligence also become a form of artistic production? Culture, Courant points out, was created collectively for thousands of years in the form of authorless myths and epics. The concept of the lone creative genius is a comparatively recent development, and a tenuous one at that. End quote. Now this all sounds vaguely progressive, but if you think about it just a little bit, at its root, this fancy artist statement reveals itself to be some pretty basic neoliberal ideology. Don't be so sure of yourself. You're only one individual. Who are you to speak for others or to pretend to know the common good? Human society is too complex for anything but the free market to manage, that amazing collective intelligence machine that's pushing us all towards extinction. Now, I don't think Agnieszka Courant actually believes this. In fact, in her politics, she probably is pretty progressive. But what I want to point out is that this is the kind of work, this is the kind of sentiment that is attractive to the contemporary art world. So let's ask once again, who does it speak to? Who resonates with the kind of thing that sounds radical, but on closer examination reveals itself to be just warmed over Reaganism? Well, if you've listened to other episodes of this podcast, you probably know what my answer to this question is going to be. Well-educated, professionally successful liberals. Those are the people that have a stake in appearing to be radical, while also benefiting the most from social and economic inequality. These are also the people that run the art world. So I think it's no coincidence that I see a lot of this pseudo-radicalism in the biggest museums and galleries. It's the kind of work that makes the powerful feel both good about themselves for being liberal and on the right side of history, but also comfortable that these liberal feelings are all that is expected of them, that they're not actually responsible for changing anything, and that in fact it's dangerous to try to change the system that, by coincidence, they benefit from. I'm also going to go out on a limb and say who I think these ideas don't speak to. People who are suffering, people who despair of a future, people in need of hope. I very much doubt that Ms. Courant's sculptures made of termite mounds or the neon scribble that she amalgamated from thousands of anonymous signatures on the side of the Guggenheim speak to those people. And I'm not necessarily saying that that is the only function of art, to speak to the despairing. But I do think it's worth asking, where is the art that does speak to that? Does it exist and get ignored? Or is there simply not enough hope left in the world to produce it? So, that's kind of where I'm at right now. It seems pretty clear that a major reason that so little art and so little culture speak to us today is that we simply don't believe anymore that the world is heading in the right direction. So the question in my mind is, do we have to wait for politics to step up and start doing better in order to enjoy art again? Or is there an art that can actually move us, can actually inspire us to be our best selves and to become better actors in the present moment of difficulty? It seems clear that there were moments in art history when the work was more optimistic and forward-looking. Moments like early modernism, moments like Russian constructivism, maybe even the Renaissance. But it seems pretty clear that at those times, the whole general zeitgeist was more optimistic. There is more belief in the air that things can be better here on Earth. So, are we condemned to wait around for the next zeitgeist? Or can we start with art? I don't know the answer to that question, but I would love to hear what you all think. If there's some art out there that you have seen which actually speaks, something new and fresh that moves and inspires instead of just cataloging our problems or raising awareness, I would love to hear about it. Please write to me and let me know. And even as I say these words, I'm aware somewhere in the back of my mind of how vaguely ridiculous and uncool I sound. But I don't take that to be a reflection on art or its capacity. I take that to be a reflection on the complacency that we've been trained to have in our politics, our lives, and even in our art, the place that we're supposed to be most free. We've been trained to have low expectations so that we don't feel foolish asking for more than what we are given, and so that we can claim the sour consolation prize of saying, "I told you so," when all of those high ideals don't pan out and the best that we are left with is Joe Biden. I remember, after the 2016 election, for example, Facebook was alive with calls for people who supported a more progressive agenda to start the work of giving up in advance, to resign themselves in advance to a Democratic candidate in 2020 who isn't going to be someone that they like, isn't necessarily going to share their platform or inspire them or promise a better world. And this was couched in terms of, well, Trump is so uniquely terrible that right now we don't have time to be idealists. We just got to get anybody else in there at all. But what all of these, I guess, well-meaning posts failed to say is that in one way or another, this is the argument that has been made for the last 40 years. For 40 years, there's always been some reason or another why we can't afford to be idealists right now. For 40 years, instead of inspiring us, our politicians have been managing our expectations, and our art has been raising awareness. And it's unsustainable. At some point, you have to ask for something better. I do think it is always in our power and always within our right to ask for something better. And maybe, just maybe, that fact is enough to get art to speak again. Thank you for listening. This has been Capital A.